Good morning. I greet you in Jesus' name. Thought maybe after my, ask for volunteers to help me with a project last Sunday. I was curious how it's going for you, those of you that agreed to help me. Must have been going well for at least some of you because, appreciate those of you that have put effort into that. God bless you. I think I'm pretty close to six. I actually was going to double the number for myself, so if you're at six, maybe you want to add more. That's fine. Keep going. For those of you that weren't here, I had, not to launch along into that, but I had asked them in the next 2 weeks to join me, all those that wanted to, in thanking the six people they spend the most time with for using whatever gifts they have for them. So you were supposed to tell the person what gift they had and how it affected or how it blessed their life. So if you haven't got in on it, you're still welcome to join us. Okay, so I've been, like, if you think you've been keeping track, I don't know. I've been preaching messages that I had requests for. So this one, I don't know if I had a request so much as a demand for it. And I tell you, the person that demanded this one really, really needs it. I'm just going to tell you, and it was myself, so in case you're starting to get worried. Maybe get a couple history buffs to help us out here. I think there's at least some here. I'm going to write the longest war. I'd like for y'all to tell me what the longest war is. What is the longest running war? Anyone? In history. Okay, very good. Oh, you sort of leapfrogged me there, didn't you? I was going to see if I could get you caught. So absolutely, the war between good and evil. I'll change my title here in just a minute. So far as other wars go, I was surprised, and I did my research, how many long wars there actually were. The longest one is considered to be the Reconquista, which occurred in Spain and Portugal. And it happened when predominantly the Moors, they called them, the Muslims, from Africa, North Africa, Morocco, those countries, Algeria, came up across the narrow point there and invaded Spain and Portugal. And so the Christian, of course Catholic mostly, kingdoms of Spain and Portugal didn't like to be invaded by Muslims, and this set off a war that lasted centuries. The conflict began in 711 after Christ, 711 years after Christ, and it continued until Columbus sailed to the New World, or to the Americas, in 1492 was the last battle when they actually drove the Moors, the Muslims, out off into the ocean, I guess, more or less. So 781 years and 1 month. Can you imagine that? How many lifetimes? I didn't actually do the math, but that is one lifetime. It would be like, well, actually, come to think of it, just trying to put this in, that's a lot longer than what my ancestors have lived in North America. How about that? A lot longer, probably double or more. I didn't do the math real careful there. But that is long. It says it probably was one of the, let's see, what's it say about this? Millions were killed. It is undoubtedly one of the bloodiest wars in human history, and it wasn't a pretty war. They didn't fight with fighter planes and drones and things where they didn't get involved and just the people suffered. It was a hand-to-hand, nasty deal. Yet, as was already pointed out, there's a lot longer-running conflict. I don't know. The Bible doesn't really make it clear when Satan got cast out of heaven, does it? Did it happen before the world was created? Just shortly after? I wouldn't feel like there was a great gap between creation and the fall, necessarily. One of the reasons being it doesn't seem any children born before the fall would have seemed to have to eat of the fruits. It seemed like it was a relatively short time frame. Yet at the same time, whether Satan actually saw the creation God made, that's some theological views, that Satan actually saw the good things God had made and wanted to destroy it, or wanted control over it. The other would be that he had already fallen and came in to mess it up. I don't know that we know. It probably doesn't matter. But it's been going on ever since, whenever it started. Now, long wars are bad. What may be even worse, though, is this word. The forgotten war. And maybe you say, how can a war be forgotten? Of course, technically it can't if you're living in it. But how many wars do you think are currently in progress? Let's say it this way. We hear about a couple. How many would you say are in progress as considered active conflicts today in this world? Anybody want to guess? I tell you, I knew of about half of them when I really stopped and thought really, really hard. So, that help you any? There's 61 conflicts that are considered ongoing currently. Now, granted, out of those 61, only about 5 are hot wars where people are fighting probably more or less every day, or at least putting effort into the thing every day. Yet the others have sporadic flare-ups, terrorist attacks involved in all that, back and forth. And you know, what's interesting is there's many forgotten wars. Some wars, like the current situation in Ukraine, for instance, is the news media is all over it. It's in Europe, and it's important that we all know all about this, I guess, is their train of thought. But there's another, there's a war happening in Ethiopia. You may or may not know about it. It's called the Tigray Rebellion. And that's been going on for a number of years, too, and I would guess probably the majority of you here never even heard of it. And yet, it has the same effect on the people living in it. And so mine isn't here. My point here this morning is not to make so much a strong point on all the conflicts that you need to study them all out, but with the ease of information, even the things in Ukraine, for example, the danger, and this is getting maybe a little bit political, I don't mean it that way, but the danger for Ukraine and actually being able to sustain and keep that war is to keep the other countries interested in their plight. As soon as other countries lose interest, it'll drag on, but they're probably finished so far as actually being able to hold together what they have to this point. And so therefore, it is to their interest for the rest of the world, Europe, the United States, other countries that support them, to be invested in this war. But the problem is, as that drags on, people begin to just sort of phase it out and move on to other things because it's no longer a new, exciting news item. And in going on to the forgotten war, the longest running war, this conflict between good and evil, I am very afraid for myself has led to a callousness, to a moving on to where it doesn't really register in my consciousness that when I stand up in the morning, I'm in a battle. When I go to bed at night, I'm in a battle. When I drive down the road, I'm in a battle. You know, has the knowledge we have. Yes, if anybody were to ask me what is the biggest, longest running conflict, from my head I could readily tell you it's the conflict between God and Satan, between good and evil, light and darkness. I know that, but do I live my life that way? Do we really realize that you are in a battle for your very spiritual existence? Are we aware of this spiritual battle? Are we aware of spiritual dangers as we go throughout our days? You know, as I lead out in my home as a father, am I aware that there's a spiritual battle? It's not just what Joe likes and doesn't like. It's not just how I grew up and what I want to continue. But there's a battle between good and evil occurring in my home. Are we aware that in our school there's a battle for good and evil? And I'm so glad for Christian teachers. It's not that I have a problem there. But teachers, be aware there's a battle going on. This isn't just a job. This isn't just another way to fill in my day. There's a battle being fought. When we get together, whether it's Sunday morning, whether it's in our brethren's meeting, I sure hope the battle is not among us, as in person to person. But there is a battle among us, and that better had be the battle between good and evil and the resistance that we have towards evil. You know, it's one thing for us to realize that this battle is real. If somebody comes and says, you're a Christian, and then beats me up, right? That's easy. That would register pretty high on my scale that there's something bad going on here. If I was thrown in prison because I preached a couple Sundays ago and I'd be sitting there in a cell, longing to see my family, it'd be pretty easy to say, yes, there's a battle going on. If there was some witch doctor somewhere trying to put a curse on me, it'd be easy to say, there's a battle going on. And you know, I think that's the very thing that the devil loves. He has one or two goals in this battle thing, is to either get us so frightened, and I'll talk about that more in a minute, where we focus on the wrong thing, or he wants us to go to sleep and forget that the battle exists. And either way, he's won. Either way, he has won. You know, when we go to work, when we stay at home, when we take a trip, when we do our daily routine, when we go shopping, when we balance our checkbook, there's a battle. And coincidentally, where I'm at in that battle, where my allegiance lies, to some degree shows itself in those actions. Safety lies in realizing we face a very real danger that will require all of our preparation and effort to overcome. You know, it's one thing to see the battle in you and say, oh yes, you've got something you got to buck up and do, brother or sister. Get awake, get real. But it's another thing to realize that there's a battle for me and to own my battle. No one gets a pass. I'd like to read a couple scriptures on this, so please open your Bibles. First of all, to 2 Corinthians 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10. I have three passages I want to read. Then I'll go on with some of my thoughts for myself mostly. Maybe they can bless you as well. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 3. 2 Corinthians 10, 3. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ, and having in readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Now, I don't know about you. I can get some general thoughts out of there, but some of that wording takes a bit of doing, so I'm going to put it in my own words rather than spend a lot of time talking about it. I'll just paraphrase this. So this is Joe's commentary, I guess, if you want to call it that. Just follow along. Verse 3. For even though we live in a physical body, we do not fight a physical battle. The weapons we use in our battle are not physical weapons, but spiritual, having God's strength to destroy the works of spiritual darkness and bondage. Thus, we can demolish conceit and the pride which exalts itself against God and hinders a knowledge of him, helping us control our thoughts as we seek complete obedience to Christ. Verse 6, having a willingness to reject all disobedience, seeking to be holy in his will. Turn over to Ephesians chapter 6. If I have a theme verse, it'd be verse 12 in this chapter, Ephesians 6, 10 through 13. Special focus on verse 12. Ephesians 6, 10. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. Back to verse 12, I'm again going to paraphrase this, but I want to especially point out that word wrestle. I don't know. Most boys like to wrestle at some point, I would say, at least unless you're too wimpy to do it. That's probably might. Even then, you probably try to find somebody that matches you and go for it. I've always been smaller, you know. That has its pros and its cons when it comes to wrestling. So anyways, be as it may, it's something I probably did way too much of, and I could still sort of enjoy a good one as long as it's not too mismatched. But you know, when you wrestle, you get rather physical, don't you? You can't stand 10 foot apart and, "I'm going to get you." "Oh, yes, I am." And you know, it sort of get old after a while. You sort of got to actually get together and grapple over this thing and see who's going to be willing to quit here the soonest. And that's exactly what he means to say here is, "For we wrestle not against flesh and blood." It's not two boys. And in this, it's actually stronger. It's hopefully most of the wrestling that I've been involved in hasn't been up to this extent, but it's called hand-to-hand combat. And so a soldier, you know, the goal of a soldier is actually not to fight hand-to-hand in today's day and age, at least. They much prefer if they can stop a charge before it gets hand-to-hand. At the same time, even soldiers today are trained how to respond hand-to-hand. It makes me think of years ago. For those of you that know, Brother Levi Mass that used to live here, he snuck up behind my neighbor one time when they were building his house and scared him really bad. And I guess my neighbor thought he almost knocked him out. He had been in the military. And he told him, "Don't you ever do that to me again." Because, you know, they're trained. They're trained in an unexpected situation to go immediately into defense mode, to be ready for hand-to-hand combat. And it's not supposed to be a pretty thing. That's not the point. So he's saying we wrestle, but not against flesh and blood, not against physical things. We're not in hand-to-hand combat with each other, or we'd better not be, because if we are, we won't get the one done that needs done. There's another thing I'd like to point out here is wrestling, to wrestle, hand-to-hand combat, is an intensely personal and individual conflict. You cannot depend on someone else to do it for you. You cannot ride along on someone else's effort. If I have a concern for our church, it probably would be somewhat down that line that so many of us for so long have been given so much that while we say, and we didn't say we believe, that it needs to be personal, I almost question whether we really live that way. It is so easy to just try to keep up a good thing, rather than just to wholly invest myself, to wholly give of myself, to realize that unless I just pour out my life, my soul, my dreams, whatever I tend to hang on to, unless I'm just willing to lay that all down and pour it out for God, it's not doing God's work. And somehow, I don't know, maybe it's just me, and praise God if it is, but somehow I get a little feeling that a lot of us think maybe we can get by with just a little bit less than everything. And it doesn't work. Let me read this again. Ephesians 6, verse 10, my words. Follow along, please. "Now, my brothers and sisters, find your strength and hope in the Lord and in his unlimited strength." Verse 11. "Be fully clothed in the protection that God has provided for you. For only then will you be able to discern and avoid the tricks and the deceit of the wicked one. For we are in an intense personal struggle, not against physical things, against other human beings. We are faced with a battle against spiritual forces, against subtle influences seeking to hold us in bondage, against the ruling and governing spirit of this world, against the world's agenda, which appeals to and distracts us." Verse 13. "Because of this, make sure you are fully clothed in the protection God hath provided for you. Only then will you be able to remain true during temptation and evil, having done all you can to be prepared." You know, the devil loves nothing more, at least this is my opinion, that the devil loves nothing more than a deceived Christian. I think that's about the absolute worst thing there can be, is a Christian who thinks he's right when he's wrong. A Christian who thinks that he can get by with investing a little bit less than everything. A Christian who's happy to be a Christian without really being holy like Christ. I'd like to turn to 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1, 3 and 4 yet. 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 1. "Thou therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that is in Christ Jesus." Verse 3. Thou therefore endure hardness as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No man that warreth entangleth himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who has chosen him to be a soldier. May I paraphrase again? Verse 1. You, my son, my daughter, be strong in the strength found in Christ Jesus' love for you. Verse 3. Be ready and willing to experience and endure difficult things and times, just as a good soldier does this for his country, do it for Jesus Christ. Verse 4. No good soldier may be obsessed and distracted by other things, but he focuses on his allegiance and the responsibilities that it brings, so as to please the one whom he serves. If my captain, my commander, was to come here before you this morning and to give me a grade of how well I've done as a soldier, what do you think he'd tell you? Have I allowed myself to be entangled, distracted, taken up with the things? Or have I wholly, in everything, tried to please him who has called me to be a soldier? Okay, the rest I'd like for you to just listen. Every war is fought without and within. Every war is fought without and within. Without, in that it involves others and things outside of our control. Without, in that we many times show the inner workings of our hearts and minds by the outward expressions of our lives. The war is fought within, in that it is more my response to what I face than what I face. You can see that over and over again. Maybe it makes me think a simple illustration would be the saying, if life gives you a lemon, make lemonade. You know, some people are good at that, other people not. Makes me think another situation. Maybe that was even shared in a message here, I forget. But during World War II, when Hitler was out to annihilate all the Jews, and he was there just slaughtering them, there was one, in one of these horrible camps, there was one back, or building, where they had one group of people, and I'm not saying none weren't killed, because they would kill them for any reason. Yet at the same time, this group of people came out, these Jews, came out of that situation way different than the millions of others. And the one big differentiator that they came up with was that they focused on each other rather than just focusing on themselves. Every war is fought without and within. I don't care. Yes, I have a lot of sympathy and compassion for people that find themselves in awful circumstances. But yet, friends, let me tell you, God has built us in a special way that as long as I don't turn myself into a victim, I find the grace and the strength of God to reach out of myself and my own selfish tendencies, there's hope and joy in the worst place. And it's been proved over and over. I'm not here to alarm you or to discourage you, yet I warn myself, and I warn you, there are powers beyond what we see and sense in this world. Powers that work best when we either panic or disregard and discount them. I think I might have shared this earlier this year, but there's a couple lines from Henry Longfellow's one poem. Life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Dust thou art, to dust returnest, was not spoken of the soul. Now notice the next two lines. Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow finds us further than today. We're not here for pleasure. We're not here for sorrow. We're here that each tomorrow finds us along the path that God has for us, just a little further than what yesterday did. Of greatest consideration should be our motives. It is more why we do what we do than what we do. Now, let me go on to say, that is not to say that what we do is not important. It is simply saying that my motives for doing what I do are an even bigger deal than what I do. So let me ask myself a couple questions. How is this battle fought in the way I choose my friends? How is this battle fought when I either choose how or how not to spend my money? How is this battle fought when I either plan or unplan my day? How is this battle fought when I stand before my closet door or my mirror? How is this battle being fought when I make business decisions, when I plan the menu? How is this battle being fought in either my use or non-use of technology? I don't want to make it difficult for you to live. I'm not trying to indicate God is standing there with a stick ready to crack you every time you make a mistake. But friends, as you do those things, there's a battle being fought. Don't fool yourself. And those seemingly small choices, when put into a series, show where I'm at with God. If you are not fighting a battle, if you don't see the battle in any of these areas, may I beg you to stop and consider, because it means that somewhere you're missing the important things, because there is a battle there. How is the battle being fought in your heart and in your life? You were put here for a purpose. That purpose was not a purpose of your own making or choosing. That purpose will most likely also not be one that you would necessarily desire, at least not in all its aspects. Yet in this, I want to hasten to say God is not unreasonable. And at times, he graciously does give us a glimpse of his plan and his purpose. But in actuality, let me go on and say this. It is not ours to choose the task, and it is not mine to question the reason. It is not ours to understand the purpose. It is not mine to ask, why me? It is not ours to ask, why must I face this battle? It is not mine to ask, why should I fill this role? It is ours to accept the task. It is but ours to accept the reason. It is but ours to trust the purpose. It is but ours to fight the battle. It is but ours to do the work. It is but ours to give our all and to do our best. It is but ours to then rest, knowing we have done what we could. Our path, my path, your path, is laid before us by a power much greater than our own. In moments of doubt or fear, it is our task, our responsibility, to make our feet go where our hearts would wish not to tread, no matter the perils that await us on our way. I'd like to look at three human responses to conflict, to battle, and then one that I think God wants us to have. So the first one, human response to conflict is panic and obsession. Panic and obsession. A wide-eyed, terror-filled fearfulness, dashing madly about, seeing potential danger at every turn, unable to rest, unable to trust, even fighting with those who would be fighting for us if we allowed them. Makes me think of one soldier that was in Vietnam. As they walk through those jungle trails, for those yet familiar with Vietnam, it's a very jungly country. And they came to this village, and they were so glad to be out of the jungle trail where they couldn't tell whether the guerrillas were there to shoot at them or not. And they sort of ran into this opening, and as they just thought they'd reached safety, they triggered some landmines. And these things just went off everywhere and killed a number of them. And basically his words went, "We went berserk." And he said, "We shot everything in sight." That's panic. That's fear. That's terror. That's hopelessness. Nothing is so disheartening as fear. Nothing is as dangerous as an obsession. In this battle against evil, or with evil, let me tell you this. Evil may never become the focus, or the very thing you battle against will become the thing that controls you. And I've seen very many sincere, well-meaning, I'm going to say Christians, fall into this trap in that they become so consumed with the battle. And yes, the battle needs to be fought. But that the very thing, in a different shape or form, that they seek to avoid becomes a thing that controls them. And it's devastating. A focus on evil will lead to fear. A focus on evil will lead to questioning God. And many has been the sincere seeker who became fascinated with the power, with the strength in evil, and found themselves sidetracked far from truth because of that obsession. A focus on evil will lead to fear and questioning. Thereby, we will end up calling darkness good. If I, at all costs, say I'm going to have to deal with this, I will simply be one step away from being willing to use dark methods to deal with dark things, thus darkening my own heart. It gives a place for evil to thrive in us. Friends, the only thing we can do is focus on the light. Yes, we fight evil, but we focus on the light. Okay, the second thing in how humans respond to conflict is bravado and carelessness. A reckless disregard of danger, self-confidence that I can handle it, I'll make it, it won't affect me, I've got this covered. Illustration of that would be, again, that was in Indonesia, I believe. If any of you have read Brother Andrew's book, how he got into the war there in the Dutch part of Indonesia. And he went sort of crazy in his own way. He got a yellow straw hat, and he would just dare, just reckless, crazy, just dare people to shoot at him, yell, just party. A reckless disregard, that's another thing that can happen. It's feeling like, and you know, friends, if we do this in a spiritual battle, we're again lost. Lost as can be, because you can't do it. I don't care how confident you are. Confidence doesn't win spiritual battles. Third one is a disregard and neglect. And I wonder if perhaps this is the one we're most in danger of here in our culture today. Just a callousness to the conflict. Yes, we know in my head, I told you, I know there's a conflict. I know there's things happening. I know there's bad things, but it's pretty far away most of the time. I just sort of can tune it out. I just live my life. I try not to be too bad. It won't happen to me until it does. Until it does. You know, it makes me think again to give you an illustration of how I see just a mental image I have is for those of you who've been in Kenya, maybe you can associate with what I'm going to tell you. I've traveled a fair bit, but I think Kenya takes the cake of the places I've been so far for people's just disregard for traffic. I mean, if it's 2 inches between them and your mirror as you go by, that's pretty good. It seems like some of them think. And they're so blasé about it. It's like, and okay, so I would think it might, I could sort of, as a human being, sort of understand that, okay, so you have so many people, seeing somebody get hit on the road maybe isn't world news there, okay, but still that they don't value themselves more than that. I mean, come on. I'd be like, at least take care of yourself, even if you can't take care of everybody else. But no, just step out, stand there, just disregard, neglect. It'll work out. Until it doesn't. I will say this carefully. There's a really recent article about someone that fell into what we would call gross sin in our circles. And they wrote something about some things they had learned from it. You know, they made an interesting statement. They said, I was that person who said I would never do this. Yet when I was presented with the opportunity, I fell. You know, the reason they fell was not because they didn't have convictions, not because they didn't feel it was wrong, but because those feelings were based on a feeling rather than on absolute commitment to be what God wanted them to be. And I really wonder, I'll stop. Let's just stop it with me. But how different am I? I would like to say I'm different, but am I really? If any of these responses to danger and battle, any of these responses, the fear, panic, obsession, the bravado, recklessness, the disregard and neglect, any of these, if I respond in any of those ways to the spiritual battle, I actually increase the danger of becoming a fatality. You know that? You can sort of see it, can't you? Let's just take a battlefield, like we often think of, soldiers lined up, either shooting or arrows or bullets or whatever at each other. You know, if you have a fellow that goes berserk in one of those trenches, he's not real safe. Okay, he's going to stick his nose out at the wrong time at the wrong place because he's not thinking straight. The one that's just bravado, jumping out like Brother Andrew there before he was a Christian, you know, he's going to get shot as well, unless God spares him like he did Brother Andrew. Well, he did get shot, he just didn't get killed. Because there again, it won't happen. Yes, it will. You know, if you just disregard, I'm just going to live my life, it's no big deal, and you forget to keep your head down one time, that's it. Spiritual battle's not that different. If you want to increase your chance to be a spiritual fatality, do any or all three of those. Thankfully, I believe there is a response that God wants to see, and that response is what I will call sincere and trusting commitment. Sincere and trusting commitment. You know, I have to accept that there's a battle to wage, a life to live carefully. I need to make preparation. I need to find others who can be trusted and who have the same goal and focus as I do. I don't live in fear, but I live in preparedness. I remain objective about danger. I'm going to give you three traits of a good soldier. So I'm going to start with one I already told you is commitment, loyalty, and trust. Three traits of a good soldier. Commitment. I wish that something, I think we need to hear more of it. It's always been a need. Staying true no matter how you feel, no matter how difficult the task, no matter how wonderful the reasons you could have for not doing it, that you still do it. No matter how much other people would excuse you for doing the wrong thing, it's still doing the right thing. I guess this has probably always been so. It seems like there's a lot of it today. And I just like to warn myself and you. You know, so much time and effort is spent and invested in helping people feel right. So much money is spent. So many pills are swallowed. So much time is invested. So much even health is sacrificed to help people feel better about themselves. Countless programs and hours are invested in trying to help people feel to help people feel like doing the right thing. And I've been involved in some of that. And I'm not trying to make it bad necessarily, all of it. Because guess what? I like to feel good as well as anybody, I believe. But I will say this, just simply based on some of the experience I had, is that you can never invest enough to make somebody feel like doing the right thing all the time. It just never works. And it leads to a lot of frustration, pain, and just wondering. Again, I'm not trying to be totally negative, yet so much of these efforts are misplaced and misused. Dear friends, may I tell you this morning, it's not about how I feel. It's about what I'm committed to. When we make a vow at baptism to be faithful to God and to the church, we're not promising to feel a certain way. When you make a vow in marriage, you're not necessarily promising an endless feeling of love. Sure, when you're at the stage Pina is, you almost think you could. And I have a wonderful marriage, don't get me wrong, but it's impossible, Pina or anyone else. We are promising, not necessarily to feel. It's great when those come. I'm not down on when they come, when they're a gift from God. But what I'm promising when I make a vow is to do the right thing regardless of feelings that will come and go, ebb and flow. You know, I fear at times, especially for our dear young people, that we almost give a wrong impression on this thing. When I endeavor to promise something that to me is a feeling, you will always find yourself wanting. To promise to feel a certain way is ultimate folly, as nothing is sure than that that feeling will change. Then what do you do? What I can promise is my effort, my actions, my commitment to continuing no matter how I feel. And I don't think I said this earlier. I do some of these adaptations, but I did borrow from Tolkien on a few of these. The way of faithfulness is committing to pay the price even when the cost is not known. And how true that is. I was almost 16 when I first asked Christ to help me in my life. And in a way, I wish I'd have done it sooner because it kept me out of a lot of trouble and regrets I have. On another hand, I'm glad it wasn't sooner because maybe it showed me how some things that I feel some people miss sometimes. But you know, even then, even though I was older than some, I had no clue what that price would be for following Christ, did I? I had no clue that it would mean that I'd be doing this in 2022. The way of faithfulness is committing to pay the price even when the cost is unknown. Trusting Him who knows the end and has promised it will be worth it. And I speak as a man now, but at times that cost will seem too dear, friends, let's face it. Many times it does to me. The cost seems too dear, like it's just too high, just too much. But commitment will dictate that I simply keep on serving, regardless of what I feel. Moving on to the next one, loyalty. I would like to suggest that maybe that's an almost lost trait in our culture. Not completely. But loyalty. Seems so many homes, there's not much loyalty between parents and children. Seems like so many churches, there's really not much loyalty. We move around as we please, how to get away from what we don't like here and go there and hope that's better. And again, I'm not slamming all that. I'm just simply saying how it can affect us. And I appreciate, I think there's some of you that are very loyal here, just to, but you know, in work, again, our culture is not. In fact, that's been a big problem these last couple years is when there was a demand for workers, when they exceed the demand for workers exceeded the supply, I guess, so to speak, a lot of people were job hopping. And we're really actually, as pools did it, with ending up worse a lot of the time than what when they started. But there was a lack of loyalty. You know, loyalty saves us from a lot of grief. I'm not saying be blindly loyal. But, you know, if you're making a change, make sure there's a good reason for it. Loyalty, I'm going to define it as a long-term commitment to being true. You know, Job expressed loyalty there in Job chapter 13, verse 15. I understand Job's feelings were way down. I mean, they're about as bad as mine are some days, and I don't have near as much excuse. But Job 13, verse 15, the first part of the verse, he said, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." That's loyalty. Job didn't understand what was going on. Job, I don't mean to be harsh, but he had actually, I feel, even focused almost on the wrong thing from the correction God gave him later. Job was confused. He was baffled. He was discouraged. I think to some degree he even felt hopeless. But one thing Job had is he was committed and loyal. He said, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." Well, God wasn't slaying him. Not at all, dear Job. But yet it felt like it. You know, he didn't understand the reason. He didn't know the purpose. Yet he planned to be true. True to the promises made. True to the ones depending on him. True to the task assigned to me. Not only true, but taking it a step further, trusting the one I serve in the dark as well as in the light. Being committed to following him wherever, however he leads. And that is terribly hard. I do not know where the path leads. I do not know what will be faced. But this I know, I will give my all to him who knows the path. And I will sacrifice my all to him who directs my steps. Let me also say the loyalty goes beyond simply plodding along determinedly. It means that we trust, that we even think well of the one who has called us to this path, difficult as it may be. That we appreciate the one who has given us this work to do, much as we would rather not do it. Loyalty means that I have a joyful desire to serve him, even in the night and even through doubt. That leads me to the last point. Is of a good soldier, trait of a good soldier is trust. I don't know, friends, if there's anything that's harder to do than trust. I would almost say not. And I'm sure it varies where this hits you possibly, but if you've ever faced a battle with trust, which I trust all of us will have a battle with trust sooner or later in some way, I just don't think there's hardly anything more difficult than trusting when you don't feel like it. That is just the absolute max of a battle a person can face, I think, based on my little experience. Trust is so difficult and yet so needed. Let's just go back to a physical sense. You know, a good soldier may not second guess and doubt the plans and the directives of his commander, may he? You know, if each individual soldier out in that battlefield was saying, "Well, I don't know." So, you know, they have their chain of command, but if each private was saying, "Well, I don't know what the sergeant's saying, but that's not going to work." And each sergeant was saying, "What the captain told me to do, that's dumb." And the captain was saying, "Well, what the colonel told me to do is not working out." You would have absolute chaos. Their security is in trusting the people that direct them. So is yours, so is mine. We must be willing and content to simply fill the role, no matter how small, and trust the one giving the guidance. Trust that there's a plan that goes far beyond what we can see. Trust there's a purpose which is too big for me to understand. It is simply for me to do and to give my best and then to rest in trust, knowing that the rest is under his control. The plan and the purpose, while obscure to me, will lead to victory as I simply follow orders. Back to Henry Longfellow. Act, act, in the living present, heart within, and God o'erhead. Lies of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime, and departing leave behind us footprints in the sands of time. Footprints that perhaps another sailing o'er life's solemn main, a forlorn and shipwrecked brother, seeing shall take heart again. Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate. Wow. Still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait. Some of these things are so difficult to learn, aren't they? You know, we think of great power as that which makes a great display. We think of things that change the world as those famous or infamous deeds recorded in history. Yet, friends, this morning, may I tell you that is not how it is. It is the small things, the everyday deeds of ordinary folks that keeps the darkness at bay. It's the everyday deeds of ordinary folks that keeps darkness at bay. It is the simple deeds of kindness and love that, when left undone, make this world dark. When done, they push the darkness back, bring light, and change the world. In the end, the darkness and all who succumb to darkness are but a passing thing of time. Dear brothers and sisters, friends, find the light. Only then will the darkness not find you. Let's kneel for prayer.